We will start with the two cases that are the first two cases on our cases for oral argument this afternoon, and then we'll take a brief recess after the second case, approximately 20 minutes, 15 minutes, and then we'll start with the third case. So if we're ready to proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Joe Spins, here today for the appellant, Gerald Orman. This case presents cross motions for summary judgment in the probate court. And there's really two issues I'd like to address, two major issues. I think the first was raised as a ground in my client's motion for summary judgment, the defendant below. And it also includes the first ground in the cross motion filed by the appellees. And that is really a fight over, I think, what is the proper accrual test to apply to both parties or to my client's limitations defense. And then the second issue deals with what I have labeled in my appellant's brief as ground two in the cross motion for summary judgment filed by the appellees. And that deals with what I have called in my brief sort of a legal fiction that my opponent created by claiming that our defense to the interpretation of the provision in the will at issue, i.e. the definition of tangible property, was somehow in and of itself a suit for declaratory relief and that suit was somehow time barred. So those are the two issues that I will speak to today. The first one goes to the heart of my client's limitations defense. And my client's position is simply this, that under Conrad's will, the 1982, when he died in 1982, there's a term that bequeathed to his wife, Eleanor, surviving wife, all tangible property. And it's our position that under Texas law, tangible property has continually, and we cited cases in our brief, I believe footnote 9, that since 1950, tangible property has always been defined to include real and personal property.
Do you agree that she was treating it otherwise?
She may have been treating it otherwise.
Who, when she was treating it otherwise, was in a position to object from, let's say, limitation standpoint?
Well, I guess to answer your question, I think I'd have to say object to what?
Object to her treating it differently from the plain wording of the will.
Okay. There may have been no one who was required to object to that. It's almost like a bank error in your favor. If tangible property means what tangible property means under the law, the fact that Eleanor may have treated it differently or interpreted differently does not mean that she's doing anything wrong. She simply may have been operating under an improper interpretation. But if it means what it means, it could never be a detriment to the beneficiaries, even if she was treating it incorrectly, because they still would never have been entitled to anything. And that's a fundamental premise that I think the appellees base their entire argument on. Somehow this idea that if Eleanor, in fact, was treating the estate of Conrad differently than the definition of tangible property, that somehow that harmed them or created some estoppel effect, but it can't. There can't be detrimental reliance if you were never entitled to it to begin with. And so it may be that she was making mistakes in her treatment, as an executors often do under an estate. They simply handle the estate wrong. But if they're handling it wrong, in essence, if that was the case, she would have been handling it in a way detrimental to her. She would have been putting things into this trust that she didn't even have to. So again, the idea that anybody would be put on notice to have to object, it certainly wouldn't be the beneficiaries, and if she's handling it wrong, her failure to object is of no moment.
But who would they have sued? In other words, they would have had to sue her for distributing extra income to their share? I mean,
well, I don't think they would have had to sue anybody. If the idea is, in this case, they're claiming that she was treating it as tangible personal property, and therefore the oil and gas interests were going into the trust. The reality is, if they had sued her and made that claim back then there would have been a fight over the definition at that time. But again, I think the issue is, you know, the law is clear that persons interested under an estate, and by the way, I did find a case, because I think in the appellee's brief, they talked about, well, wait a minute, these beneficiaries, these nephews and niece were contingent beneficiaries, so maybe that would have never even made them an interested person. But there's a Supreme Court case, 260 Southwest 2nd, 592. It's a 1953 case. It's Laros versus Hartman that says contingent beneficiaries, or people who are even have a contingent interest under the will, are interested persons. So, and I'll be honest and frank with the court. I think there is perhaps some merit to the accrual test they cite as it relates to the cases that it was used in. But what's contrary to this case is you have a will probated in 1982. You have beneficiaries who are clearly interested under the will. The law says that interested persons are charged with notice of the contents of probate records, including a will. It's much like deed records. It's under the law considered a constructive type notice. And that the Declaratory Judgment Act specifically says that persons interested under a will have the right to sue to have the will construed. So when you take all of that and you couple it with Texas law that has defined tangible property forever and ever and ever as including real and personal property, our position is how could there not at that point be a controversy under the law that would require them, if they really believed that this will meant tangible personal property and their construction is adding words to the will, how could they not at that point have been required to bring suit? And I will also say that I think our accrual test fits in well with the policy of the state of Texas, because there are a myriad of probate cases in dealing with limitations that says the fundamental purpose is there is a special need for finality in probate cases. And so in this case, the appellee's accrual test, which is basically, and I don't want to put words in my opponent's mouth, but basically their test is, look, the beneficiaries can take a unilateral, subjective interpretation of a will, and then they can sit on their hands and wait, and in this case, 20 years, until they believe they receive notice from an executor that the executor is going to treat the will differently than they interpret it. And so, you know, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to realize that could create, I mean, all sorts of limitations issues, and certainly make no estates final. Our jurisprudence is full of situations where courts interpret wills and deeds and oil and gas leases to have the phrases have definite and distinct meanings, and that's what we have here. So anyway, our position is with regard to ground one, the appropriate accrual test is, as we have stated, that their cause of action for declaratory relief to construe the word tangible property to mean tangible personal property accrued at the time the will was probated, because they were put on notice of the contents of the will, and under law they were clearly interested persons. The second issue which I want to address, and this was, I think, again, clear harm to my client. After we filed our motion for summary judgment, which really dealt with the accrual test, the appellees filed a cross motion, and they really raised two grounds. Ground one, again, was sort of just a mirror ground back as to which accrual test ought to apply. But in ground two, they made a clever, if not incorrect, argument. And here's what they said in the cross motion. This is at page 8 and 9 of their cross motion. That's at clerk's record 1548 and 49. And let me backtrack for a second. In paragraph 83 of their Fourth Amendment petition is where they allege this defense that comes out as ground two in their cross motion. And in their cross motion, here's what they said for ground two. They said, look, the Mr. Ormond's, my client, the appellant's argument that tangible property meant what it meant, and they should have filed suit back in 82, and that it only means real property. I'm sorry, it only means real property. They said what that is in substance, and that's the technical word they used. In substance, that is a suit by Mr. Orman for declaratory relief against the appellees. So they start with a legal fiction right off the bat. And then they say, and because their defense here as to the interpretation of tangible property is in essence or in substance a suit for declaratory relief, that suit for declaratory relief is barred because Eleanor should have brought that 20-something years ago. Our argument is this. The trial court was incorrect and committed error in granting that portion of the summary judgment. First of all, because it's based on an incorrect legal theory. And at page 39 and 42 of our brief, I cite those cases which talk about you can attack the validity and propriety of a summary judgment if an appellee, or in this case, we're the appellant, but we were the respondent in that case. We didn't file a response to the motion, and that's clear in the record. But the law says you can still attack the propriety of a summary judgment motion if it's based on a legally incorrect theory. And that's our first argument, that the appellees weren't entitled to sort of create this fictional argument that somehow our defense to their declaratory judgment action requesting an interpretation of tangible property somehow morphed itself into a suit for declaratory relief back against the appellees, and it's barred by limitations. And I will note, and I put this in our brief, there is a certain irony that when we get to this point, the appellees argue that Eleanor should have brought that way back when. It's somewhat inconsistent with the appellees' position on the first point. Suddenly now, for Eleanor, her cause of action, if she had a suit for declaratory relief about the interpretation of tangible property, well, gosh, Eleanor had to bring that some 20 years ago. And so I think there's an inconsistency in that argument. But for our purposes, our position first and foremost is it's simply a legally incorrect fiction that they created, and the court just erred in granting that portion of their summary judgment. We've also thrown in an argument based on Civil Practice and Remedies Code 16.069, which is an extension argument, I guess, based on their legal fiction, that if the court were to believe that my client's defense was, in fact, a counterclaim for declaratory relief, which, again, there is no, that's a fiction, there is no counterclaim, we didn't sue for declaratory relief as a counterclaim, that that portion of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code would say it was timely because when we answered, and that provision says that if someone files a claim against you and you have a cross-claim or counterclaim over and against them, it's timely even if it would otherwise be barred by limitations so long as you file it within 30 days. And again, there's nowhere in the record to look to see where we filed this suit for declaratory judgment because there is no suit for declaratory judgment. But had there been one, it was clearly would have been in, as part and parcel of our answer because, as I cited in our reply brief, Texas law says that when you answer a suit, you put in dispute all allegations. Well, when we answered their declaratory judgment suit, their suit said tangible property means tangible personal property, and we denied it. So, therefore, our defense would have been raised at that time, even if characterized as a suit for declaratory relief. And the last thing I'll say about that, I think what the appellees were trying to do with that, and they've put a little bit of that in their brief, I think what they were trying to do is really raise some sort of waiver or estoppel, probably estoppel-type argument. And the problem with that is if you look at the cross motion again at 1548 and 49, that ground isn't raised. It is truly the ground of your defense is a suit for declaratory relief and it's barred by the statute of limitations. And I think the reason they had to twist and sort of create this legal fiction is I think because their estoppel argument, obviously they have problems with it. It's if their position on limitations on ground one is we never knew anything about how they were treating this or how until they put us on notice. How could they prove any sort of detrimental reliance or what have you all through the years Eleanor was handling the estate? So in any event, our position is number one, the court should have granted our summary judgment because the accrual test starts when the will was probated and their suit was time barred, and certainly as to ground two in the cross motion, again, this legal fiction that somehow we filed a suit for declaratory relief and it was time barred should be reversed. Thank you.
Hey, whoa. Uh-huh. Now, obviously, the nephews and nieces are benefiting from the way in which Eleanor treated the estate. And we obviously are here because if Ormond, your client's method of construing the will, means that Eleanor should have treated it differently, then there must be others that benefit from your construction of the will. Yes? or we wouldn't be here. I mean, why are we here other than there's some other people that are going to benefit differently from the nephew's and niece's construction?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Now, it seems to me that they're sort of the real parties in interest. And so my question to you is, if their benefit under this construction, which is contrary to Eleanor's, why didn't limitations run as to the real parties in interest, that is, your construction of the will, when Eleanor is treating it differently from their interest?
You're going to have to ask that one more time. I apologize.
There are different people from the nephews and nieces that are going to benefit under Ormond's construction. If these people were aware that she was treating it different from their construction of the will, why hasn't limitations run as to them, that is, their construction of the will, which is Ormond's, your client's, construction of the
will? Well, I understand now. And I think that gets back to the exact answer I gave you previously of this idea that if, in fact, there are people on Ormond's side who will benefit from his construction, they would have, even if they had a claim or could have sued or back in 1982, the bottom line is if the construction means what it means, and that's an issue in this case that's before this court and down in the probate court below, if it means what it means, they don't have any need to sue. It's going to come to them. Because the construction of tangible property, including real and personal, means it all went to Eleanor. And then under her estate, which Ormond, you know, is involved with, it's going to go to them no matter what.
It kind of sounds like that in some circumstances that would just gut all affirmative defenses and all statute, including statute of limitations, by saying, well, it was done wrong. And that's what prevails. It doesn't matter when you decided or when you learned or when you knew it was wrong. It was wrong from the beginning.
But I think that happens all the time in the law. I think a lot of times executors handle estates over many years, and there may be situations where they simply didn't handle it the way the will required. And where that leaves the parties, it may leave lawsuits against the executors. Who knows? But I think that's the issue. Because either way, whether their claim is barred or not, we're going to make a determination in this case at some point what tangible property in the will means, and it's going to fall out however it's going to fall out.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spence. Mr. Whitehill, we'll extend your time for a couple of minutes at the end if you need be, just because Mr. Spence was answering a question from the court.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Your Honors, may it please the Court, Bill Whitehill for the plaintiffs, appellees, the Florences, who are the contingent remainder beneficiaries under Connor Florence's will. And that's an important fact in this case. But before I get into my argument, I want to address some of the points that came up in Mr. Spence's argument. It is correct to say that from day one, back in 1983, Eleanor Florence took a position that was adverse to Mr. Ormond's position in this case. She took that position in the estate tax return, the Form 706. In that form, she disclaimed any receipt of Mr. Florence's separate real property under the will. In addition to that, she determined that, in fact, the separate real property went into the trust created under that will. We know that from the numbers that she put in the will. She said that at least $473,000 worth of assets went into the trust. We know that from the Schedule M in the will. The only way that that could happen under the will and the balance sheet in the estate tax return is if the separate real property interest went into the trust. Now, that has consequences because at that point in time, she was wearing at least two hats. One hat was her personal interest. If, in this will construction case, Mr. Ormond's position is correct and that the will construed as a whole means that the separate real property went to her outright, in her individual capacity, she would have received it outright at that point in time. That was her individual interest at that point in time. But she was also wearing another hat. The other hat she was wearing was that as the executrix of the estate and as trustee of the trust. And under that hat, she had a duty to preserve trust assets for the beneficiaries, which included her as an income beneficiary and the protections that went with that, as well as the remainder beneficiaries, the Florences, the plaintiffs in this case.
Excuse me, are you saying she did a formal disclaimer of particular assets as opposed to just it being a result of how she reported it on the probate estate inventory and the estate tax 706 form?
It's the latter. Okay. When you look at the Schedule M, there's a section at the top that asks to declare the property that she received outright, and it's not on there.
Okay.
And then you add up the numbers of what goes into the trust, and that's there. But in 1983, when she did the Form 706, she took a position at that point in time that this separate real property went into the trust as opposed to going to her outright under the will. And she maintained that position from that day forward until the day she died. And
what effect does that have on Mr. Spence's argument that if it was wrong in the beginning, it's wrong now, and it gets corrected now?
Well, because Mr. Spence is arguing the merits of the case, and that's an argument that at some point in time, Judge King will take care of when we go back down there. But we're here on a limitations question. We're here to decide today whether the Florences have an opportunity to go down to Judge King's court and make an argument. Now, we're not here in this appeal to debate what the meaning of tangible property is. And in fact, we're not before Judge King to determine what the meaning of tangible property is, because under Texas law, the rules laid out by the Texas Supreme Court and by this court in the Eccles versus Davis case is you construe a will as a whole. You read the document as a whole. It's just like a contract. And you have to, if you can, give every provision in the will meaning. And when you come to wills, you have a little twist on that rule, and it's called the dominant intent rule, established by the Texas Supreme Court in the Bergen versus Bergen case. And under the dominant intent rule, you look, of course, the fundamental principle is determine the testator's intent from the will as a whole. Okay? And you can discard and should discard isolated phrases, sentences, even whole paragraphs that are inconsistent with the dominant intent shown by the will as a whole.
Are we arguing the merits that you just got through telling me a minute ago we weren't here to talk about?
Well, I'm explaining why we shouldn't be talking about the merits, so I'll quit talking about the merits.
All right.
But that's the problem with his argument on appeal. He's trying to say because my argument should win in the trial court that the case should be barred on limitations, and that's putting the cart before the horse. That's saying the limitations argument, the key to the courthouse, is determined by the ultimate outcome of the case. And that's just not the way it works in Texas. The Tankersley case that we cited in our brief is not a will contest case, but it's a similar situation in which the court said limitations and merits are unrelated issues. What's at issue is the accrual test. And noticeably absent from Mr. Spence's argument was citation to law supporting his accrual test. And that's because there is no law supporting it. They've had two briefs in this court, a brief in the trial court, opportunities to cite a single case that supports their accrual test, and there is none. But there is case law support dealing with the issue.
Well, who was it that was going to come up and bring this to Eleanor's attention?
Well, that was the problem Eleanor had. She was to bring it to her own attention because she was on both sides of the equation. Remember, she had a fiduciary duty to make disclosures to the Florences as to what her position was if it was going to be adverse to them. She didn't make that disclosure. And in fact, fundamental to the case is there has to be a controversy somewhere. There never was a controversy from 1982 when Mr. Florence died until August of 2004 when Mr. Orman, and remember, he is Eleanor for all purposes in this case. He's a personal representative. 21 years later, after the 706, he reverses course and creates a controversy that never existed before.
But if she was incorrect, I mean, a limitation supposes that there's someone to bring a limitations argument. Who was that here?
It was Eleanor Florence.
If Eleanor was doing it wrong, not prejudging, if Eleanor was construing the will wrong, who was it that was going to bring something within 4 years?
Eleanor could have brought a declaratory judgment action.
Why?
Saying, I want these assets to come to me individually.
But if
she basically would have had to sue herself.
Well, no, she would have joined the Florences in as interested parties in the case, and at that point in time there would have been a controversy because the assets at that point in time would have left Connor's estate and gone to her individually, and it would have been appropriate to sue the Florences at that point in time. But it was not appropriate for the Florences to sue at that point in time because there was no controversy. Nobody had done any overt act that had put them on notice that Eleanor was not going to abide by their interpretation of the will. And that is the standard that the Supreme Court adopted in the Murphy versus Honeycutt case.
Well, controversy presupposes two people. And who was there besides, who was Eleanor having a controversy with? Certainly not the nieces and nephews that were benefiting from her construction of the will.
That's our point exactly. There was nothing to put them on notice that they needed to bring a declaratory judgment suit.
Hence, why is there a 4-year statute of limitations involving Mr. Orman, who did not appear until Eleanor was deceased?
Because I'm understanding the court to be talking about the second part of the argument, which is the judgment declaring that Mr. Orman's claim.
I'm just asking, you said, you know, we have a controversy, and I'm saying there is no controversy between Eleanor and the nieces and nephews. Therefore, who was there to be a controversy with that would put somebody on notice, oh, I better act because Eleanor isn't acting in accordance with the will, and I've only got 4 years to do it after she starts, as you said, in 93, signing tax returns and so forth, contrary to what the plain wording of the will indicated. Who was that?
Well, as a preliminary matter, I disagree with what the plain wording of the will indicated.
All right.
But certainly the Florences would not bring suit because as contingent remainder beneficiaries, they may not have anything at all. I mean, she's got to die first, and there has to be something left in the trust, and she has to not exercise her power of appointment. And they're not on notice of an adverse claim, so there's no reason for them to sue. Eleanor, however, remember, Orman, he's a beneficiary under her will. Not only is he the executor, but he is a beneficiary under her will. He could have brought a suit at that point in time.
Is he adversely affected by her construction of the will?
Absolutely. But that means that the property at issue, Conard's separate property, remember this is property inherited from his father,
right,
goes into the trust, and what's left over when he dies goes to the Florences. If it went to her instead as an outright gift, it would be going to him right now.
But doesn't that mean, though, the cause of action cannot accrue until Eleanor dies?
It depends upon whose cause of action you're talking about. Eleanor would have been in a position to say, I think the property comes to me outright, but I have a fiduciary duty to the Florences over here that creates a conflict of interest. And in order to resolve my conflict of interest, I ought to go bring a declaratory judgment action, sue the Florences, and get it resolved, if that's how she construed the will. But she didn't construe the will that way. The lawyers that drafted the will didn't construe it that way. And in fact, Mr. Bartell, who was involved in drafting the will, testified that no, the construction that Mr. Orman is offering today is the wrong construction. That's not what was intended. It's wrong. So everybody involved with this case, even Mr. Ormond, up until the end of July 2004, agreed with the plaintiff's construction of the will. Remember, in 2003, he signed a check on behalf of the trust dealing with the mineral property. So even in 2003, he was reading the will the same way that the Florences read it.
Well, did I sidetrack you when you were trying to explain to me why? Basically, if I said, I will you all my cars, and, oh, well, it really meant all my red cars. I mean, we're inserting a word in here that is not here. And I think maybe I interrupted you when you were trying to explain to me, you read the will as a whole, and you do this and do
correct
that. Inside the four corners of the will, how we can read it the way that you read it?
Well, yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. When you look at Article 2, it conveys the house to her. And so there would be no need to talk about tangible property the way he did if he was intending to convey all of the real property. But more importantly, when you look at Article 3, the very first sentence of Article 3 says that he's giving the rest residue of his estate, including real property, to the trust. And further on in the will, in Article 2, it directs the trustee, Eleanor, to maintain, hold on to mineral interest, specifically mineral interest, as long as it makes sense to do so. Now, that language wouldn't be there if he didn't intend for real property interest, including the separate property mineral interest, to be in the trust. And so at a minimum, at an absolute minimum, the will is ambiguous, which is that's a substantive issue that for Judge King to decide what it means.
Mr. Whitehill.
Yes, sir.
What is your view of the dominant intent of Eleanor in the way that her will was written in designating Mr. Ormond as her independent executor and leaving the balance of her estate to her nieces and nephews separate and apart from Florence?
Well, whatever is the residue of her estate goes to Mr. Ormond and the rest of the residuary beneficiaries, but it begs the question, what's in her estate? And were these assets ever in her estate is a question that has to be determined by Judge King in this case when construing Mr. Florence's will. And the dominant intent of that will, reading it as a whole, is, we believe, summary judgment. We got a summary judgment motion pending.
And if, as a matter of law, the definition of tangible property includes the mineral interest, then as a matter of law, wasn't the intent in the part of Mrs. Eleanor's will to leave those assets to parties different than your client?
No. No, because, granted, tangible property includes real property. There's no question about that. If that were the issue in this case, we wouldn't be here. The problem is you've got to read Connard's will as a whole to determine what he intended to do with his separate real property interest.
I guess that's where I'm falling off with you. I'm not understanding why you read one will as a whole and you read the other one in part.
Well, because if we're correct in how you read Connard's will, these properties never became part of her estate.
Okay.
She never obtained personal title to those properties. And they wouldn't pass under her will at all. It's just a non-issue.
So what you're really saying is that basically what you're saying is you're leaving off the word personal property and just saying the realty is disposed that we're concerned about is disposed in other places in the will. And it doesn't have to say personal property. It really can say the property not otherwise disposed of in the will, tangible property not otherwise disposed of in the will. That's really what you're saying.
Well, in essence, that's what it comes down to. The residuary clause
disposes of property not otherwise disposed of in the will, and the fact that he used tangible property, okay, if there's some realty not otherwise disposed of somewhere in the will, then it goes. But what we're concerned about here did go somewhere else in other parts of the will. That's what you're telling us.
No. What I'm saying is that there's separate personal property that belonged to him. Now, we've got to decide what happened to it under the terms of his will. And if all we did was look at one phrase in Article 2 of his will and ignored everything else, it would go to Eleanor outright at that point in time. Okay? But Texas law says that's not what you do. You read the will as a whole. Look at all parts of it. You look at Article 3, you apply the dominant intent.
I think I got it.
What we're asking the court to do in this case is simply follow what the Texas Supreme Court in the Murphy case, Murphy versus Honeycutt case, established as the rule for determining when a cause of action in a will construction case like this accrues. And in that case, the rule is very clear. The court said, until the execution of the deed, in that case what happened is there was a will that was ostensibly ambiguous, although, as it turns out, it's not ambiguous. The question was, did the will leave the real property to the widow as a life estate or outright such that she could grant a deed to somebody else? She grants a deed to somebody else. 13, 14 years later, after the will is admitted to probate, she signs the deed. The remainder beneficiaries at that point in time then file a declaratory judgment suit saying, wait a minute. We need to construe the will because she didn't have title to convey to the grantee. All right? And the exact same arguments that Mr. Ormond raises in this case were made in that case. They argued, look, read the will. Anybody could see that there was a controversy on the face of the will. This claim is barred by limitations. And the Court of Appeals and subsequently the Texas Supreme Court said, no, that's not the right test. You have to have a controversy. Not only do you have to have a controversy, but until the execution of that deed, the record discloses no act on part of the life tenant, the recipient under the will, violating the terms of Buck Honeycutt's will. And, of course, the appellees, as remaindermen, had no cause of action, and none accrued to them until Ida did some overt act showing that she was not going to abide by the terms of the will, as construed by the appellees, the remainder beneficiaries, the people in the same position as the Florences.
Mr. Whitehill, I have one more question for you, sir, if I can redirect your attention to
sure.
the inventory filed in the original will. Was there any item that was classified as intangible personal property listed in the inventory?
I don't know that anything was broken down in that fashion. I'll have to check the record and let you know.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your argument. Thank you for answering our questions and your presentation.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Vance.
Your Honor, unless the bench has any questions, I'll get back the remainder of
my time. I'd ask you the same question I just asked Mr. Whitehill, and that is in the original inventory. When we're looking at dominant intent within the will, and we're talking about language referring to all tangible personal property, was there anything classified as intangible property?
I don't know the answer to that question. My recollection is that there was not. And the other thing I would add along those lines in Article 2 that Mr. Whitehill brought up, this idea that it gives the home to Eleanor. And then he says, so the use after that of tangible property, if it included realty, would be redundant. The key language there, though, says, I give my home to Eleanor. And then later it says, and any other tangible property. So that word actually, that wording actually supports the idea, I've given home, which is realty, and any other tangible property. So thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
I could address that. I misspoke. What I meant to say is there would be no point in giving her his interest in the home if, as Mr. Orman contends in this case, the tangible property conveyed all of his real property interest. That's where the redundancy comes in.
Thank you for your presentation, Mr. Whitehead. Your case has been heard. Thank you for your argument, both of you. Your case will be submitted.